and to our consultants.
Thank you. Okay, so today I intend to do two things. The first is to prove, at least in the case of full shift, the theorem on the boundary of the connected components of the hyperbolicity locus that I stated, and I will recall in a minute, I stated in the first lecture. And afterwards, after the proof, I will try to, I will give an example, rather, it's not really a theorem, but an example with the full shift on three symbols, which shows that the situation is very much different from the situation for the full shift on two symbols that I studied yesterday. Okay, so let me first recall then the statement of the theorem. I'm giving the general statement on with the subshift, but as I said, the proof will be only in the case of the full shift, essentially because the notations are easier to manage. So sigma should be a subshift of finite type of the full shift on n symbols. So given this full shift, I have the hyperbolicity locus. So the set which sits in parameter space. Parameter space is the set of n uples of matrices in SL to R. And H is the connected component. I will be a connect of H. So H is open. And the theorem is as follows. Consider a point which is in the boundary of this component here. Then one of the following occurs. So either there exists a point X in the shift space which is periodic for the shift map, and such that the corresponding matrix, so it's a product of these matrices along the cycle given by X, this matrix is parabolic. So this is the first and simpler possibility. The second one is what I call the heteroclinic connection. It means that there exists Y, XY in sigma, again periodic. I will use another letter here. Both points are periodic. And then a third point which will belong both to the unstable manifold of X and also to the preimage of the stable manifold of Y. This is why it is called heteroclinic. It will behave in the past like X and in the future like Y with a shift in time. It just means, let me just recall what it means. It means that Z as a sequence will be written like that. In the past, you just have X up to time zero. So this is Z in the past. Then you have a free part, which would be what any symbols with the compatibility rules of sigma. And then past this one, it has to be like Y. So this is periodic here with two different periods, and then a transition here between the two periodic regimes. Okay? So this is just this is exactly the same. Okay, so such that if you consider the unstable direction for So for the periodic matrix associated to X, so this is the product again, the same that appeared here. But now it will be hyperbolic, so such that first, A, K, X, and A, no, it's A, L, sorry. A, M, Y, and lost, are hyperbolic. And so let me put this. And if you consider the unstable direction of this hyperbolic matrix, apply the product corresponding to this block here, then you will obtain the stable direction associated to Y. So this is this one. Okay, so it means again that if you consider this direction at time zero, okay, in the past it goes down exponentially fast because it is an unstable direction. And in the future, the first n step, you use this matrix and you fall on this one, and once you are here, it's a stable direction, so it goes also in the future to zero exponentially fast. So this is heteroclinic connection, and this is clearly not compatible with uniform hyperbolicity. Okay, but the point of the theorem is that there are the only two obstructions to uniform hyperbolicity when you go on the boundary. I mean, when you lose hyperbolicity, there are only two possibilities, either because one matrix corresponding to some periodic orbit becomes parabolic, or because you get some heteroclinic connection. Uniformly hyperbolic is everywhere. Globally uniformly hyperbolic. Okay, this is so. If you lose somewhere uniform hyperbolicity, you are no more. The definition of the hyperbolicity locus is this one. I'm not sure. Yeah. No, what I'm saying is that the definition of the hyperbolicity locus is that the cocycle should be uniformly hyperbolic over the rule of sigma. I'm not sure this answers your question. There is a complement here. I will put in the let me just put here is that the integer actually there are many possible x, y, z, but the integer that come in, the periods k, l, m, and the number of iterates to go from x to y here, the transition period, all these are bounded here by a constant which depends only on the connected component. Okay, so you have only a finite number of choice, say, for the matrices which appear here. Finite number of possible products. Okay, so this is the thing that I want to prove. And as I just said, I will prove that only in the case where sigma is a full shift, just because the notations are much easier. But the proof is really not different, except for the notation. Okay, first I have to, let me just recall that I introduced yesterday the set, so now sigma is the full shift, A was the alphabet, and so the. So I consider the set of stable direction in the projective space, one-dimensional projective space, of and similarly the set of unstable direction. So I get in this way two disjoint compact subsets of projective space. And we have seen yesterday how to fill partially KS and KU to get two compact sets. steps, which are still disjoint. Essentially, I just recall the definition without writing the definition. S is the complement of S is the union of the complement of, so, sorry, I will draw the picture, it's probably easier. So this this would be, say, in red KS and in yellow KU, and what I'm doing is filling the things. For instance, like that, filling the things in order that they still do not intersect, but now they have only a finite number of components which are alternating. Okay, and these are called the stable and unstable cores. Stable and unstable cores. This is when you are uniformly hyperbolic. So the stable and unstable direction are defined everywhere. Okay, now, so before proving directly the theorem, I have a couple of lemmas. And the first one is the following. So in the two lemmas, I'm assuming that the parameter is not on the boundary, but inside. So I will only go to the boundary afterwards. Okay. So it's in this case, I'm saying that if for V, so assuming that V is a boundary point of the unstable core here, then there exists some index here such that the inverse image minus one of V belongs still to delta U. Okay. Alors, what is the proof? Well, first you have to observe from the construction of U and S that U, delta U is actually contained in KU. This is clear, I guess. And the second thing is that a characterization of points which are on the boundary of U, so given V in KU, it's easy to see that V, so given this one, V belongs to delta U if and only if there exists a point W in KS, an open interval in P1, such that the boundary, so it's, I could, is just V and W, so I'm not saying in which order. This is the reason I didn't want to write W, VW or WV, but it's one of the two possible intervals with boundary points V tilde and W tilde, and such that E, which is open, does not intersect KU. So the boundary intersects because the point V tilde is in KU, but the interior of E, which is open, does not intersect. Okay, I guess again, this characterization is rather clear from the construction of U and the boundary. Now I will use this characterization. Well, so now I'm proving the lemma one. So I have this point V in delta U. So first, from the fact, yeah? No, KU itself. Here, no, for a point which is in KU, I am saying this is true if and only if this is true. It's just a characterization. Okay? Which points of KU happen to be actually the points on the boundary? Is this clear? I mean, it's essentially to look at the drawing and you are convinced in principle. I mean, Now, starting with the point V, which is the boundary point of U. Okay? From this fact here, V can be written as some U of X. Okay? Now, I will take E to be the letter, the E which is here, to be the letter in position minus 1. Then, the point V star, which is a minus 1 of V, the point that I am interested in here, okay, this will be just U of sigma minus 1 of X. So by definition of invariance of the unstable direction, and so it is in KU. Okay, I want to check that it is actually in delta U, so I will apply this criterion here. So it satisfies this condition, I want to apply this. So from the criterion and the fact that V was a boundary point, I can find E with delta E equals, I can find W, E open, and I does not intersect. So I find these things here. I will apply a minus 1 to everything. So I take I star, I should have said before. Let me just recall also that in this setting, the set KU are always positively invariant, while the set KS are negatively invariant, and the same is true actually for the now I'm back here. So I star will be the preimage of I. So similarly, I will define W star as the preimage of W. So I will have that delta I star is V star W star. And this point, because of the property on KS that I have here, this point is in KS. W tilde was in KS, sorry, yeah, W here is in KS. And so the preimage is always in KS, or all EI actually. So I have a point in KS, I have an interval, an open interval whose boundary point is here. I have just to check that this intersection is empty. But it has to be empty because if I have a point in the intersection, the image by AI would be in this intersection because KU is positively invariant. Okay, so a point in the intersection would be in this intersection, which is empty. Okay, so this is empty actually, and so I've checked the criterion here and proven that the point V star is actually in delta U. So the lemma is proved. Okay, so this was the first lemma. Don't need the proof. The second lemma is to now to describe actually all points still with the hypothesis that the parameter is in H, that I claim that there exists K and M, so I say, exists X with sigma KX equal X and Z, and M. Alors, M plus K will be bounded by the number of components of U. So U, U is the unstable core, it has a finite number of components which is the same throughout H. It will be only be deformed when I vary in H. So this is a constant that I am just calling C, which depends on H. Okay. The specific U depends on the parameter, but the number of components do not. That only depends on the component which contains the parameter. Okay, such that, sorry, let V again in delta U, such that V is actually obtained by some, alors I should have put, yeah, okay. So there exists also E1, EM, such that I obtain V by taking the unstable direction corresponding to a k of x, so this periodic point which appears here, and then applying a finite number of matrices, and again the period plus the number of matrices here is uniformly bounded. Okay? So I'm describing here, it starts to look like something like that, I'm describing the points on the boundary of the unstable core. So the proof is very easy. I will just apply, iterate lemma 1. I start with V0 equal V, and then I can define Vn recursively from lemma 1 by such a formula, and I want to stay in U. The index E I is not unique, but I just choose one index at each step in order to stay on the boundary of the unstable core. Okay? Well, because U has only finite number of components, and actually I will repeat, alors the number of boundary points should be twice the number of components, but actually if you are a left boundary point, you can easily check that what you get here is also a left boundary point, and also, so it's not important for the proof, I could just use two here if needed, but actually you don't need it, it's just that there exists ample k with k strictly positive and m plus k less than this number, such that Vm is equal to Vm plus k. Just your finite sequence, finite number of possibility in this set. You have to repeat after some time, equal to the number of elements. Okay. And now if you look just at what it means, it means that if you look, so let me write this in the right order. Yeah, it's im plus k minus 1. This product will actually be the product corresponding to a k of ix here. This matrix apply to vm plus k, which is vm. Is actually equal to Vn. So it means that this is an eigenvector for this product here. I'm choosing X in order that this product is this matrix here. And choosing X like that, this is an eigenvector. It has to be the unstable eigenvector because these points are in the Ku. And Ku and Ks are disjoint. You cannot have any stable eigenvector in Ku. Okay? Ku and Ks are disjoint. The stable eigenvectors are all in Ks. So this is actually an unstable eigenvector. It is, therefore, this one. Okay? And now you use the other one is actually, or probably written in the other direction. And the same thing that if I want to be coherent with this notation, I should write the product here like that. Yeah?
You said that you chose those a sub I m so that the product is a k.
No, I'm choosing x so that, no, the a I are defined by the iteration of the lemma. So, okay, and now I'm just writing this sequence and repeat with this period k. I have just written the indices, and I will just repeat, this is just the definition of X. Write this sequence of indices and repeat with period K. And this is the point X. I should be, you see, you have to be slightly more careful with subshift of finite types. And actually for subshift of finite types, you get a bigger, larger bound here. You have to be careful with the possible transition. So you get still a finite bound which depends on H, but which is not as simple as the number of connected components. Okay, so this is lemma 2. Now I can start really the proof of the lemma, the theorem, sorry. Okay, now what you do is consider now a point which is in the closure of, so I still want to allow A to be in the component, but also to allow to go to the boundary. So I consider a parameter in the closure, and I will make also some assumption. When it is on the boundary, I will assume that any product like that, with L is less than this constant here, that this is different, actually, well, say hyperbolic. Well, this is obviously automatic when A is inside, but when I am on the boundary, it's an assumption. It's an assumption, but when I want to prove the theorem, if the assumption is not satisfied, I am in the first case. Okay? So I will assume that the first case is not satisfied and prove that I am in the second case. And so I'm assuming, I'm considering parameters which satisfy this. So, okay, in this case, what I'm define, I introduce a finite set, actually, which is exactly the set of points which appear here. Okay, so they are the set of points of the form A. Alors, where what I am allowed, so M plus K should be less than C of H. Here, I have any periodic point of period K, and the any choice of letters here. Okay, so it's a finite set. It's a finite set, which is, as you see, what I have proven. I've proven that when the parameter is in H, so this is defined under this assumption, because I want to be able to talk about this point, and here K was bounded by C of H. So the matrix which appears here is hyperbolic, so I can talk about the unstable direction. Okay, so this is well defined whenever this is makes sense, whenever this holds, sorry. Now, when the parameter is hyperbolic, I've just proven before that this set contains the boundary of U. I've just proven that any point in the boundary is of this form. On the other hand, this set is also clearly contained in KU, because the unstable directions are contained and KU is positively invariant. Okay, so I have some finite set which is larger than this one, not necessarily strictly larger, but at least as large as this one, but certainly smaller than this one. You define in a similar way using inverse of the matrices here and stable direction here, you define in a similar way a set S star. Okay, now the point is that still in this case here, where you can talk about stable and unstable core, you can still recover U, S are obtained from U star S star. As I would say as before, or as from KS, KU, thus you feel in the maximal possible way these sets in order for them to stay disjoint. It's still taking the connected components which do not have the same phrase that I used for KS and KU. So from Uzeb, so by feeling, say, by feeling and staying disjoint. Okay. Well, this is for the hyperbolic case. The other very important, the important thing also to observe is that this set here, it depends continuously on the parameter, continuously in the Hausdorff topology. Actually here, points have names, you can even follow individually the points. But so it depends continuously on the parameter. Okay, now, so what I want to prove, actually, that I have some heteroclinic connection, and this, for this it is sufficient even for bounded KLMN here, and for this it is sufficient to show, what I want to show is that when I am on the boundary, and the condition of hyperbolic product is satisfied, I would like to show that this is non-empty. If I show that this is non-empty, saying that two such points, one point of this form here and one point of the opposite form are equal here, I can just send the inverse on the other side and get exactly the relation that I want. Okay? So, I have to prove that. So, I will assume that for some parameter on the boundary, I still have two disjoint sets. Now, if I have two disjoint sets, I can proceed as I just said for the hyperbolic case. Assume that I have that for some A1, AN in the boundary now, and with the hyperbolic condition as above. So I can define SU, as I just said, I mean, again, by filling in. Staying disjoint. It's a new definition because I'm not hyperbolic. But the point is that now I want to check. So this is the variation on the multi-cone criterion that I gave yesterday. What I want to show, I'm recalling the properties which guarantee that the parameter is actually uniformly hyperbolic, which would contradict that. Okay. Well, first, SU are compact disjoint. Well, this is the process of filling in staying disjoint guarantees that it's this way, and also that I have each one have a finite number of components which are alternating. Again, this is automatic by this process, starting with two disjoint sets. Start this way. Now, I have two properties to check. This is for U, that U is positively invariant. And similarly, that S is negatively invariant. So this is here that so to prove that, now for this parameter, I'm just observing that if I'm taking a sequence in H now, which goes to this parameter, which is on the boundary, then for these parameters I can define a star U star, and the corresponding, because of the continuity here, it will converge to the S star and U star for the limit parameter. Now the process of filling in and staying disjoint is continuous. So actually the unstable and stable course that are obtained when I am inside will converge in the Hausdorff topology. They are just union, finite union of intervals. They will converge in the Hausdorff topology to this set SU. But because these properties were satisfied when I was inside for the hyperbolic component, for the stable and unstable core, by going to the limit in the Hausdorff topology, we'll have both these properties. Okay? So this is true. And the last condition that I needed is that no product is equal to the identity. I needed to have this for L less than the number of components of U, which is here C of H. And so I explained that this implies that actually the parameter in this case is uniformly hyperbolic, which is contradicts this hypothesis. Okay, so actually this assumption of being disjoint is not possible, and so we have proven that you have proven some relation of this type, some heteroclinic connection. Okay, now I want to explain the corollary, which was the semi-algebraicity of both H, the connected component at its boundary. So I'm using only very elementary facts on semi-algebraic sets. Perhaps not all elementary, but at least very standard. Yeah. No, it's definitely not true, sorry. In the case of two, yesterday I described all components in the case of the full shift on two symbols. Alors, let me just recall without writing what was true. In the full shift of two symbols, there were on one side the principal components. And for the principal component, on the boundary of the principal component, the situation was more precise, because actually I get either this, but with k equals to 1. So it means one of the matrix, A1 or A2, A or B, will become parabolic. Or here, I get here n equals to 0. Actually, what happens is that I have a relation like something like that, really. Or the opposite. So it's a very trivial relation in this case. This is for what I call the principal component. But the other one, this did not appear, if you recall. This was not appearing at all. Okay? But on the other hand, I could have three possible matrices, and the matrices could be of arbitrary length. Alors, there are very special matrices. There are so-called Sturmian one, which you start with A, B, and you, after that, from A or B, you make either the C substitution or the opposite one. So, you make an arbitrary large number of substitutions, and so you get very long matrices. But you get also very complicated. The components go away to infinity. So when you fix the components, you have only three possible matrices actually. But No, it's bound. No, it depends on the component. But the number of components is infinite. It's fixed. It's completely given by the component. But when you let the component vary, it takes any value that you want. Again, there is an infinite number of components. And I explained in the first talk that it's an open question for the full shift on three symbols or more, that the boundary of the hyperbolicity locus is actually the union of the boundary of its components. So this is the reason I was prudent here. I'm assuming that I'm the boundary of some component. It doesn't mean that a general point on the boundary, I don't know actually. This could be true, but I don't know. Okay, so for semi-algebraic, I'm using, that it is stable, that's a semi-algebraic set. Are stable under the following operation. So linear projection. So this is Tarski-Seidenberg theorem. And then I'm using topological operation, so interior, closure, complement, boundary. And also taking a connected component, a semi-algebraic set has a finite number of connected components, and taking a connected component. Each one is semi-algebraic again. So I want to prove that H, so in particular, I will prove that H itself is semi-algebraic, and it follows that the boundary is semi-algebraic. Now, how you prove that? Well, it's very elementary. Hein? You consider, C is for this constant C of H, which appears here. Okay? So you define two sets. Let me. The first one is a simple one which corresponds to the parabolic case, is a set of parameters. Such that some product, so I will write the trace of some product I'm taking all possible I1, IL, there exists such that some of this matrix is parabolic. So this is polynomial in the coefficient. And so this, and also this set is an algebraic set in R4N, so it's a semi-algebraic set here. Alors, the second one is slightly more tricky. I'm starting with, not really, because just I'm using, there is this unstable direction, I mean, not you have to, it's why the reason that I need to use Tarski-Seidenberg. Is that not only A1, AN, but also I will use, so this is, the beginning is still matrices, and then I have two numbers, real numbers, and two vectors. So now let me, I want to write, so there exists, I will write again in the form which is here. So Z like that here, or I could just use Z0, Zn minus 1. Say with L, M, N less than C. And such that, so I want, so AK of X, which is a product of this matrices here according to the point X, applied to W1 is lambda 1, W1. It's EL again, yeah. EM of Y applied to W2 is lambda 2, W2. then the n of this, which is really this a, the n minus 1 a 0 w1 is w2, which corresponds to this relation here. And now I also want to say that lambda 1 is larger than 1, lambda 2 is smaller than 1, saying that I have an unstable vector and a stable one. And finally, that w1, say, is different from 0, 0, otherwise I will be in trouble. Okay, I guess that I've written everything. So this, alors, this is again clearly a semi-algebraic set. Hein? Yeah, yeah. This is the set that I'm interested in, because what I'm just saying is that now I'm so I'm just projecting, so I will project on SL2R to the n, forgetting, eliminating the lambda and w variable. So I will just write p for the projection, and then so p2 st, which is by this is just a definition, s2c is semi-algebraic. And now the thing is that I'm claiming that h is a component of the complement just because I've proven H is connected, and I've proven that the boundary of H is actually contained in this set. So because it is connected by definition, and the boundary is contained here, it has to be a connected component. So this set was semi-algebraic as a union here, the complement was semi-algebraic. And then taking a connected component, I get something which is still semi-algebraic. So this proves the corollary. I recall I have not written the calorie. The corollary of the theorem is that H and delta H are semi-algebraic. And I'm recalling again that hypербolicity locus itself, this big H, is not semi-algebraic because it has infinitely many components. Okay, this is all that I wanted to say about the theorem. In a few, 10 or 15 minutes that are left, I will try to give some rough idea of this phenomena of heteroclinic bifurcation. The phenomena is that with the full shift on three symbols or more, I can have a sequence of distinct connected components accumulating on some component. And this was definitely false for the full shift on two components. For the full shift of two components, I claimed that a compact set intersects only finitely many components. Here it's completely not true. So I will essentially make some drawings to try to explain, but not really make proofs. So I'm starting with the so-called three components for two matrices, which was like that. I had, so let me use color again. So this is my matrix B, this is my matrix A, and then I had so this should be BA here and AB here. So this was the combinatorial description for the non-trivial principal component, the simplest non-trivial component for the full shift on two symbols. So now I have only two matrices, but it is hyperbolic. I will introduce a third matrix. Let me use another color because the third matrix will play a different role. The third matrix will be a C like that. And again, it's an example. So I'm thinking of A, B are fixed, and I will move the matrix C along one parameter family. So I will have actually a C as a C of T. T will be a one parameter family. For T negative, it will be hyperbolic, but the triple ABC will be in a fixed hyperbolic component. It will be inside, okay? Then I will have bifurcation at T equals zero. And for positive T, you will be for some value of the parameter in infinitely many distinct components, okay? So, C will always be like that. The difference is what this point is u, b, here, the unstable direction of b. And this point, when I look at the image for, so this is ct of u, b, this is sa here. And for t negative, it will be like that. And then it will cross here. And for t equal to zero, you will have equality here. So first, why is, when for negative t, why is the situation hyperbolic? So I have to look at still this multicone or unstable core sphinx. The unstable core in this case will be this interval up to this point here, C U B, and up to this, this is U of A B. Union with this. So I will have some multicone with two components. You can check that the image, well, the image by A and B does not cause any trouble because AB wasn't the free component which was okay already. But the union by C, you see this point is going precisely here. So this, the image of this interval is going here. I cannot go farther than that because if I'm going here, if I start using A, you see that A will push things on this side by in this direction, but if I'm going through that, then it is going the other direction. I won't be able to apply the criterion. So just to, I'm not doing really a complete proof, but I've tried to explain very rapidly why for this case, this is uniformly hyperbolic. So this is before bifurcation, the kind of trivial. The dynamics is well understood, with a multicone with two components. It's, in some sense, it's the simplest component which is non-principal, not the principal component, but for the full shift on three symbols. Now, let's look at what can happen after the bifurcation. So, I will make a partial drawing. So, I'm using again this BA here. I will choose two points, P, Q, like that, say, and then alors, you should think of A and B are very strong matrices. Strong means that the eigenvalues are very large. So, for instance, UB is very attracting, and the point BP will actually sit somewhere like that. On the other hand, I want to look at the image of this point by BAQ, and it will BA here, this UBA which is attracting, so this the point will be somewhere like that. So these two intervals will be important. This interval I will call G naught, and this interval here is called I naught. So I want to start iterating this interval positively. So I will So by B, so I will just use B n of Bm of I0 defined as, no, it's n really, sorry. Bn of I0 to Bn, it's a sequence which accumulates here. So I1 would be here, and they will accumulate on this one. And iterate negatively by A here. So it will again converge G1, G1, and they will iterate here. Okay? And let me, okay, I will make one more. Now, what I want to do is to get the following picture. So I'm drawing again. Now I will draw this part of the picture horizontally. So, and I'm not respecting the size, okay? Just the order of the interval. So I0 is here, G0 is here. So I have some, I'm thinking of now GM as being large here. I have some SA, which is here, which is the limit when M goes to infinity. On the other side, I have UB here. I would have IN minus 1 here. And then I will call the IN would be here, and this larger interval going up to the limit here, I will call IN star. Now, for T equal to zero, this point, the point here, for T equals to zero, was going exactly on this point, at the parameter. What I would like is to choose, find, so I need to find Mn arbitrary large and T which depends on Mnn, very small, positive, such that the following holds. So I want, alors let me check, not, I want to have Ct of En star, so this interval here going inside Gm that you see here, and Ct of In minus 1 going on this side here. So in SA, I'm putting plus infinity just to say that it is what is beyond SA. Okay? So, alors, this, bon, this is, you may impose condition initially on AB. You have to impose condition. Alors, I will just write the condition, and let you see at the paper or try as an exercise to show that the conditions are sufficient. What you need is actually, in order to be able to do that, okay, you need two conditions here to begin with. It's the first one, you consider the cross ratio UA, so UA was up here, yeah, you see still UA on the top, UA P Q SA, the cross ratio of the two points. Alors, I'm taking the version of the cross ratio which is always larger than one. So, let me write the cross ratio ABCD for four points in this order. This is C minus 1 A over B minus A, D minus B over D minus C, okay, times. So, this is always larger than one. And the log of the cross ratio is a version of the hyperbolic distance with in the interval AD. So I'm looking at this cross ratio larger than one, and the other one, which is U B B A Q. So U B is here, B A Q is here, then a P and then S B. Alors, on the picture, both alpha and beta are larger than one by definition, but they are rather close than one, to one, on the picture. What you need is actually the opposite. You need alpha or beta or both to be large. Actually, this is the condition that you need. In the point is that, in a sense, when you look at the picture here, you want this, this hole here, and this hole must at the here contain this one. So, okay, so, you want this to be relatively large with respect to this in a hyperbolic sense, and this translates in a condition of cross ratio. And you want also to adjust the size, so the other condition that you need is that the ratio of the log of the eigenvalue, these are the log eigenvalues of A and B, the ratio of the log is irrational. This is easy to obtain by perturbation. But you have to check that this property, sorry. CT of UB, CT of, CT, yeah, CT, UB is an extremity here. So it should be somewhere here. Yeah. Huh? Yeah, yeah, it varies with T, exactly. So the point, you have to take the size right first. And this is by choosing M and N appropriately, and in order to be able to have the size right, I really need this condition here. And once the size are right, I'm choosing B by translation in order to stop at the right point here. This is the choose of choosing T is very easy. The problem is checking what is necessary to choose M and N. Okay, now once you have this situation, I claim that actually, you have a situation which is, for these parameters, uniformly hyperbolic. Alors, I'm again not really proving something, but let me just write what happens and finish on that. Well, you have a large interval. You will use, again, a multi-cone criterion. And I'm writing the components of the multicone, or the multicone will be really a slight thickening of the interval that I'm drawing. But essentially, this is the multicone. There is one large component which is C, B, N, P, A, Q. The point C, B, N, P is just here. P, sorry. Because this is precisely the point which is here, sorry. This is B and P. And by C, in this condition, it is same on the other side. Okay? And AQ sits around here. So this is C. C, B and P is around here, so the V is something like that. But the other intervals I've already defined here, are the I here. And then I'm just writing the final. So this is the list of the intervals that I want to consider. And these are the free matrices. I want to see what happens applying the free matrices to this list of intervals. Alors, I'm just looking inside, It's just not equal that I'm writing, but I want to see that each of these intervals is going inside another of the intervals. I'm just making, listing the results. So for instance, here it's a V up to here, and even up to here. And then G1 goes to G0, Gm to Gm minus 1, and finally V to V. So this is clear because the D were defined by taking the image. Well, it's on the other blackboard, but B is easy also. At the beginning, it's like that. Then it goes to E1, and then G0 goes to E0. This is also easy to check, and all the rest actually goes to E0. Again, you have to, it's very easy to check. And finally, C. Well, C, the only non-trivial thing is that it was written here. En star goes to GM. It was made for that. And all the rest goes to B. Everything, V is a large interval. It's not surprising that it absorbs a lot of things. But now the point is that from this, it's easy to check that by thickening slightly this interval, you get a tight multicone. And so what you prove is that for this particular value, A, B, and C for this value Tmn, this belongs to a parabolicity locus. And the corresponding multicones, if you count, have m plus three components. So, in particular, it means that because they are tight, so these are invariant of the corresponding components. So it means that you are really for different m and n, when this sum is, it's easy to see that the ratio m over n is actually going to this log lambda, so r over log lambda b, the ratio of the log eigenvalue. So I mean, but it's not, I mean, you have to choose carefully m and n. So it's not all values of m and n that will appear, but still you have infinitely many possibilities for m and n going to infinity. And so it means that you are, for t m n going to zero, m and n going to infinity, you are in a sequence of components which are distinct are each time more complicated. So this is an accumulation that does not occur for the full shift of two symbols. And also which seems to indicate that it should be difficult to obtain any classification result for the connected component of the hyperbolicity locus in this context, because I don't know, but it's a priori not impossible that then I could have on this new component still have some accumulation thing. It's actually a question that I mentioned slightly different form, but let me just conclude that the question is that if you gamma is an analytic curve, does gamma, if I'm looking at the preimage of the boundary of the hyperbolicity locus, I don't know whether this can have countably many components, at most countably many components. Here we have the phenomena that if you cross this curve T of T was an analytic curve, could construct as an analytic curve where, well, at least I have countably many components, okay, on this, on the compact part. But if the accumulation is, more than a single accumulation like that, it could be even much worse. And this I don't know. Okay, thank you very much.